It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Milwaukee Film Festival kicks off Thursday, screening hundreds of films at four venues, including the revived Downer Theater. We learn about the festival's highlights, and you can call in with a question. You can share comments at any point. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Anne Reed is interim CEO of Milwaukee Film. Anne, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
I'm so glad to be here, Kate. Thank you.
So 300 films across 15 days, that is a lot. How does Milwaukee Film select which movies play at the festival?
It is an enormous project and one that our team really does with joy. You know, we know nothing connects us like film does. Nothing shows us other lives like film does. It's so important to do this, and it's so much work. If you walked around our offices during the time between the submission deadline and the time that the lineup was announced, what you would have seen was lots and lots of people with headphones looking at their screens. it was just delightful to see. We have a terrific programming staff that programs not only for the festival, but year-round. But in addition, lots of people whose normal job during the year is something else had those headphones on and were screening away.
Everyone rolls up their sleeves for this.
Exactly.
So some Milwaukee publications have put out lists recommending dozens of movies at the festival. How do you go about recommending how we pick and choose which movies to see?
This is what I'm learning, the big challenges for so many people. There are more than 300 films in the festival from more than 60 countries across four locations, starting late morning into late night for 2 weeks straight. It's not only an enormous project for our team, it's an enormous project if you're planning to come. So we've really tried to make it as easy as we can in so many ways. For one thing, the films are categorized into different programs, and both on our website, mkefilm.org, and in the physical program book, you can see them listed that way. That helps. Online, we have a special page, just the recommendations of individual programmers. This is what I like, this is what I like, kind of thing. And then just sitting down with that book and a bunch of post-it notes and a cup of coffee and taking your time and really, really running through there. Not just for the things that you've decided in advance you want to see, but the times when you're ready to let yourself be surprised and delighted by something that you that might not have been on your radar.
And I understand you have a special place in your heart for movie trailers.
I do love trailers. And it was fun preparing for the festival because I couldn't, of course, look at everything. And so I've been watching a lot of trailers lately.
Yeah, but that means that you want to take in every movie. I mean, the trailer is like the best. So
that's the reason for the trailer. But really, I have a friend who just posted on Facebook that he has identified the 55 films he plans to see over the next 2 weeks. It's possible to take in a great deal.
Follow in those footsteps. So in the mix, Anne, is somewhere in here, it's Footloose. 1984 comes alive. Kevin got Kevin Bacon. And then there's the Talking Heads concert film, Stop Making Sense. What films are you looking forward to? And how did these particular ones get in the mix?
Well, Stop Making Sense is actually a regular for us. Our community loves Stop Making Sense, and we show it every couple of months. And so for that to be included in the festival was a no-brainer. And for those who like music and old things and the ability to really let it out, Stop Making Sense is a great place to go. Footloose is associated with the live broadcast of the podcast that we do with 88.9 Radio Milwaukee, which is called Cinebuds. It's our Christopher Pollard and Dori Zori from 88.9. They do a regular podcast about film. They'll be doing it live from the festival, and Footloose is the associated film with that. It's a great favorite of Christopher's, and I know it's a great favorite of lots of others. I want to start humming the music even now as I sit here.
Anne Reed with us, interim CEO of Milwaukee Film, as we talk about the Milwaukee Film Festival gets underway Thursday. Call in questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So since 2020, the festival has had a virtual component, and this year's festival won't have a way to virtually view any of the festival's films. Why remove the option to watch them remotely?
The virtual component obviously was necessary in 2020, 2021. And like many things that we learned to do during the pandemic, it was popular. And so right now, very frankly, it's just a question of bandwidth. The organization's gone through a whole lot of change this year, and it was just a question of what we could put on and needing to prioritize, of course, first, the fullness of the physical festival itself as it was pre-COVID and trying to come back to that. I will say a lot of people have said that they miss that virtual option, and I do hope some way to find a way to get that back.
So going forward here, you're interim CEO. What are your priorities as head of Milwaukee Film and what you've brought to the organization in just recent months?
It's been amazing. As you may know, I was a lawyer for a long time early, and then I was in
Humane Society. Yeah,
I was at the Wisconsin Humane Society for 12 years. So my biggest personal priority right now is learning. I've never worked in the arts. It's amazing. This team is amazing. The depth of knowledge that it takes to do what they're doing, and the depth of operational experience and precision to put how long is this film going to be with us, how long is this film going to be with us, on which screen, how many seats, how much popcorn. It's just remarkable to watch them put it all together. So I'm learning a ton. I am trying to see how I can best help. This is an amazing group of people, and my main priority is to support them as best I can. And then I'll say, too, this is remarkable work that can't be financially supported just by the ticket price, although we're so grateful, and just by the popcorn price. In order to program with the variety that we do, in order to provide the educational options we do, bringing hundreds of kids in to see films, often for the first time, supporting emerging filmmakers, this work relies a lot on what people are generous enough to donate. And of course, it's a lot of my job to help make sure people know what a difference they're making.
Anne Reed is interim CEO of Milwaukee Film and our guide to its annual festival. It gets underway Thursday, runs for 2 weeks. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Milwaukee Film Festival is here. It returns to screens Thursday, featuring over 300 films from local, national, and international filmmakers. And they showcase a range of topics and genres. Be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. You can add your perspective at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Anne Reed with us, interim CEO of Milwaukee Film. So, Anne, in March, Milwaukee Film announces it would take over operations of the Downer Theater. Can you explain why take over this two-screen movie theater?
I sure can. The question really was, if not us, who? The Downer Theater on Downer Avenue in Milwaukee is the oldest operating movie theater in Wisconsin. Mm. It is a treasure. And it is the anchor of a thriving neighborhood, as many neighborhood movie theaters are. And the idea of that neighborhood, just picturing it with and without that theater that's been there for so long, the folks who used to go as kids, the folks, somebody just told me they've been married 50 years, they had their first date there. Mm. The idea of it going dark, if we could prevent it, just didn't feel acceptable. Our mission is to celebrate the power of film, to share the power of film. And while we can't save every theater, because neighborhood theaters are definitely at risk, we felt that we could this one, and we are so proud and excited to have done that.
Have you made any renovations or changes to the building itself?
There's been a lot of cleaning. In fact, I just saw, I think on Instagram, our team posted a reel of Kristen, our CEO, in a hard hat, kind of explaining what all they've been working very, very hard since the day we took the keys. For larger renovations, and everyone is asking us, what are you, especially about the seats, what are you going to do about the seats? What are you going to do about? And that really is going to depend on, over time, figuring out what funding is available to pursue those things one at a time. We know that the big thing to do now is turn those lights back on and get movies running again in there. There were movies running right before it closed. We can run movies again with just some cleanup. But we know from having restored the Oriental Theater only five blocks away on the mm-hmm. east side of Milwaukee into the true movie palace that it was built as, we know what true restoration means, and we will definitely be looking for those opportunities.
And that's what I wonder about, the synergy of the neighborhood, the synergy of those two theaters being, you know, just minutes apart. You can walk to them. And this is a neighborhood you know well, Anne. Can you talk about how people from out of town can enjoy going to these theaters, these neighborhood theaters, and really taking in the energy of the neighborhood itself?
Absolutely. It's really creating what we're calling a kind of a cinema district in that space, that five block space between the Oriental and the Downer. As around both theaters, there are great restaurants. There's Boswell Books, a nationally well-known independent bookseller. So much going on in both of those places. And for us to be able to run films in both means that we can introduce people to that whole area. People worry about parking on the east side. There is a parking garage right across the street from the Downer on Downer Avenue. We have parking options in the program book for all of the theaters that we're going to be at. We'll also be at the Avalon and the Times during the festival. But to come back to your question, yes, the fact we are so excited that the fact that the two theaters are so close together really elevates the immediate area around both of them and helps the city and our visitors experience that connection.
And so when the festival comes to close on the 25th of April, what films will be screening at the Downer after that?
We'll just be programming there. It will be our second year-round theater together with the Oriental. And so the full joyful variety of what you see being screened at the Oriental Theater, from big first-run Oscar-nominated films to special programs around special things that we want to be sure to recognize, like Black History Month and Women's History Month earlier this year, to fun little sequences we're still doing, an Alfred Hitchcock series, to things like Stop Making Sense. That's our space, is that amazing variety of the different ways that film can tell stories and touch us and really make us have a blast. And that's what you'll see at the Downer.
And here is such a historic neighborhood theater that people have memories of, as you said, and the National Movie Theater chain Landmark Theaters previously owned Downer Theater. In September, Landmark closed the location as part of evaluating its business strategy, it said. How concerned are you about keeping a small screen theater open and viable, you know, in this age of multiplex theaters?
Here's what I've learned, and a lot of people don't know this. The danger to neighborhood theaters is actually not our ability to watch films at home. I think I thought that, and a lot of people thought that. But in fact, lots and lots of people will see a movie in their kitchen and also go see it on the big screen. The issue is that the behind-the-scenes business of this work, the more flexibility you have among different screens, the better you can make it work. And so, you know, if you're committed to Dune Part 2 for X amount of weeks, which you definitely want to be, how are you going to fit in these others? So for us, it should, the idea is it actually will work better from a business slash financial point of view to have five screens, five blocks apart, than it has been working to have three And that it did work for Landmark to have those two at the Downer. I'm gesturing this with my hands. We think of it as a multiplex theater with a long atrium in between the three screen end at the Oriental and the two screen end at the Downer. People are coming to the Oriental wonderfully, and we definitely hope, but I have lots of reason to hope that they'll come to the Downer as well.
Milwaukee Film Festival with Anne Reed is here, interim CEO of Milwaukee Film, as we talk about the festival and beyond the venues and these beloved theaters in Milwaukee. Call in along the way with questions. You can share your perspectives, your experiences. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. And as you said before, you were a lawyer for decades in Milwaukee. You've led the Wisconsin Humane Society for a dozen years. And now here you are leading a film organization. How isn't a nonprofit like this perhaps similar or different from other organizations you've led?
Well, the thing about all nonprofits is there's work that needs to be done that people are committed needs to continue, needs to be done on the planet, whether it be finding great outcomes for homeless animals or making sure that film in all of its fullness is here in our city, and that what's now an arts institution like the Milwaukee Film Festival continues. So we decide as a community that this must continue, but these are things that don't pay for themselves in the same way that running other things that are in the private sector do. So if you think Amazon's work needs to continue, just be Amazon. But these things that if you do them just from selling tickets or quote unquote selling animals, you're going to lose money doing that because it costs more than that's going to bring in. So you bring in the nonprofit model, you bring in the ability for people to say, yeah, I want this to continue and I'm going to donate to make that happen. That's the common thread between all nonprofit work. And so that's what we're seeing here. Imagine a world where we didn't have the Milwaukee Film Festival, where we didn't have this deep variety of programming, where we didn't have us bringing in kids to see inside a movie theater for the first time. And you realize that has to continue. And when people step forward to support that, that's literally what makes the difference.
From an outsider, I thought this festival was an institution in Milwaukee, and I was surprised a bit how it started relatively recently. It scaled up pretty quickly. How is that possible?
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
16 years.
Yeah.
From essentially a blank sheet of paper to a definitely nationally recognized film festival. And so much credit needs to go to my predecessor, Jonathan Jackson. He led Milwaukee Film for those 16 years, stepped away earlier this year. And the amount of the level of vision that it took to make this happen on all of the different levels that it is, it's truly a testament to his vision.
Let's bring in Paul in Summit. Paul, hi.
Hi, good morning. Great show. I went to UWM in the 80s, and lots of movies that we saw with a lot of my former classmates at the Downer and the Oriental. So excited that you guys are taking this on. A little shout out to Sandberg Hall. They had a little movie theater in there, but there was a real movie culture at that time. And I think that this really allows the residents. And I mean, right now I'm not living there, but I'm definitely going to go to Downer and the Oriental and see a movie now that you guys are putting your thumbprint on it. Thanks so much for all of your work.
Oh, Paul, thank you so much for those kind words. And go ahead.
Oh, that's so great to hear. Thank you so much. And it's a great shout out as well to UWM. UWM has a nationally recognized film program. Behind the scenes, we at Milwaukee Film have several ties to UWM and to that film program that we're super proud of. I do have a sense that now that we're at the Downer, kind of inching our way physically closer to UWM, that that the public will see more of that outward facing and will be able to interact in more ways with the amazing work that's being done there.
Okay, so one final thing before we have to let you go. People like to eat at when they see films. Is there anything special about the food at the festival?
Enjoy. Our team has so much fun figuring out food. They try to use local suppliers every and local kind of food institutions everywhere they can. I'm a tea drinker and I can count on my reishi tea
Go
there.
find your Rishi, Anne.
Absolutely.
I'm drinking it right
Popcorn
now.
and then great restaurants around all those theaters.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. All the best with the festival.
Thank you so much.
Anne Reed is interim CEO of Milwaukee Film. And for disclosure, Milwaukee Film Festival is a business sponsor of WPR. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about new efforts to help Latinas build up emergency savings and retirement funds and the financial project underway here in Wisconsin. But first, power outages caused by extreme weather can happen in Wisconsin year-round. And for people receiving federal food assistance called SNAP, spoiled refrigerated food can mean going hungry. SNAP recipients can get replacement benefits, but the process isn't easy. And while the state has plans to simplify it, that won't happen until after the extreme spring and summer weather. Addie Costello reports.
With 9 grandchildren, food doesn't last long in Lisa Winston's home.
And every day is somebody at the school is somebody. Granny, I'm hungry. Granny, you got something sweet?
The Milwaukee retiree relies on Wisconsin's food share program to stock her kitchen with some of her grandkids' favorite foods, including
macaroni and cheese. They love macaroni and cheese.
But when a winter storm swept across southeast Wisconsin this January, she lost power for over 24 hours, and roughly $200 worth of food in her fridge and freezer spoiled.
And then everybody looked at me, I'm hungry, I'm cold. Me too! You know, I don't know what to say. We just eat peanut butter and jelly because you don't know what's good.
The federal government provides replacement benefits for SNAP households that lose food because of things like power outages. But Sherry Tussler, the CEO of the anti-hunger nonprofit Hunger Task Force, says accessing those funds isn't easy.
So you get finally the replacement form and you're like, oh, I could fill it out if it was a fillable form.
But it's not. And unless the state temporarily allows for signatures over the phone, people either have to sign it in person or print it out, then upload it online, mail it, or
you can fax it to them. How many people you know got a fax machine?
So why can't people just sign it electronically? States need approval from the USDA to accept electronic signatures on replacement forms. And even though Wisconsin got that approval in November 2023, they don't plan on making the option available until October of this year. A spokesperson for the health department says it takes time to change their systems, and they want to make sure no one's benefits are disrupted. But the agency has accepted other forms with electronic signatures for over a decade. And the delay means the online form won't be available until after tornado season.
With climate change, these storms are becoming as detrimental to households as the hurricanes that you'll see in Florida.
Melissa Kandari is the Midwest Regional SNAP Director. She says preparing for extreme weather has become a bigger priority for SNAP agencies in the region. But even once online signatures are available, an even bigger problem will remain. Many recipients just don't know that replacement benefits exist.
This is the case in every state that I've seen, where it's just not widely known.
But Tussler wonders why any form, fillable or not, is necessary after major outages. She says the state can see who lost power and who already spent their food share benefits for the month, and they could use that data to automatically replace people's benefits.
Rather than putting them through some kind of a natural gauntlet of paperwork.
The USDA does allow states to issue mass replacements. There are strict guidelines, so most states only issue mass replacements during declared disasters. But Wisconsin hasn't issued mass replacement benefits in at least 15 years.
If you got a power outage that blows through, you know, like 10,000 households went without power. It's probably time to trigger it.
An estimated 127,000 SNAP households were potentially affected by January's ice storm, including Lisa Winston's. And despite receiving food assistance for almost a year, she didn't learn about replacement benefits until her friend saw a news report about how Hunger Task Force was helping affected residents.
I'm like, wow, I never know all the sources out here to help people, you know, that's really, really in need.
She spent her last $2 taking the bus to sign the paperwork. But for Winston, it was worth it. About 2 weeks later, she got enough assistance to buy her grandkids fresh food and milk for their mac and cheese. Addie Costello, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This piece was produced in partnership with the nonprofit Wisconsin Watch. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Hundreds of thousands of Hispanic women call Wisconsin home. They earn 57 cents for every dollar a non-Hispanic man earns. That's according to the latest Latina Savings Project report, which aims to encourage savings among moderate and low-income Latinas nationally and here in Wisconsin. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Cindy Hounsell is founder and president of the Women's Institute for a Secure Retirement. That's a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit. Cindy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Great to be here with you.
Yes, and Norma Gallegos-Valles is the Workforce and Career Pathways Manager at Centro Hispano of Dane County. Norma, welcome.
Welcome. Good morning, everyone.
Norma, let's start with you. Before we dive into this latest report, can you talk about why the Latina Savings Project targets this group of people? What is the typical financial health of Latinas?
Yes, thank you. This project began in 2021 due to the lack of resources around financial literacy and wealth building for the Latino community in general in Dane County. But we wanted to specifically do this project for Latina women in Dane County because statistically, we know that Latina women live the longest, yet when they get to retirement, about 50% of them between the ages of 55 and 65 don't have retirement accounts. We know that Latina women also tend to take care of their family first, and when they get to retirement, because they've been doing caregiver for the family, and they've been saving for college and other family needs, they leave the retirement savings for them at the end. So we wanted to address this from a very strength base of what Latina women already know and what they've learned throughout their journeys as caregivers, and provide additional resources for them to start building wealth and bridging the gap of the lack of retirement when they get to that age.
Building wealth. Cindy, taking a look at that 57 cents for every dollar a non-Hispanic man earns, and over a career, that really adds up. How do financial inequities here affect people once they retire?
Well, I mean, obviously, they end up retiring it below the poverty level already. So that was one of the things that, you know, sort of piqued our attention many years ago when we first started this project.
And so when you look at that number, you know, what can that mean in terms of trying to build wealth over a career when there's been caregiving, maybe being in and out of work, where you're, as Norma said, putting other financial situations first, maybe paying for a home, your child's education?
Well, I mean, I think that's true, but I think everybody needs to know about this so they can make changes in their life. I mean, we've been working on this for over 30 years, and it's been amazing how people can make real changes in their life when they learn about this. It's like, you know, how many people come up to you and tell you, when you're in your 20s, well, you better start saving for your retirement. I mean, this April is Financial Literacy Month, so we usually try to take advantage of opportunities like that to let people know that, you know, maybe you can't do this today, but there's a time in your life where you're going to have to change your behavior, or you're going to have results that are not going to make you happy. And a lot of times that just becomes, you know, letting people know about the benefits that are out there, like Social Security. A lot of times, you know, people aren't even signed up. I've had women come and say to me, you know, well, should we join the Latina Savings Project or should we contribute to our Social Security? And it's like, it's the law when you work. And, you know, a lot of times if an employer, you know, is sketchy in some way, or you work, you know, part-time and maybe they don't include you, it's just good to know what the Social Security benefits offer you when you reach retirement age.
Norma, does Social Security come up at the education workshops and the other aspects of the learning how to save through this program?
Yes, we, during a 2.5-hour workshop, we talk about different topics. We do spend a lot of time talking about different areas of retirement. Oftentimes, we believe that only 401k is an outlet for that. And we learn that there's other options, such as IRAs, Roth accounts that can help you elevate your savings and keep something sustainable for the years to come. I think when it comes to family, Latino families, and specifically, right, that's why this type of partnerships happen, because there's still a lack of trust between other non-Latino organizations to do the work. This includes financial institutions such as banks, credit unions, because the systems work different. If you come from a Latino background, there is this mistrust that still takes place in our community. And so we're also trying to bridge the bridge, per se, between the trust of institutions. And I think financial inclusivity is very important, so that they can see us that we're part of the economy, we're part of the system. And oftentimes it comes with the collective thinking that me as a Latina woman also contribute to retirement, to savings, that because we do this collective work of care of giving or taking care of others, it is important that we take care of ourselves, so that in the future we can continue to do that. So I think we're also trying to bring it back that we as Latina women are part of the fabric of economic growth and retirement.
Norma Gallegos-Valles is Workforce and Career Pathways Manager at Centro Hispano of Dane County. Cindy Hounsell is here, founder and president of the Washington, D.C.-based Women's Institute for a Secure Retirement. As we explore aspects of the Latina Savings Project, call in with a question. You can share your perspective, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. For Latina women, lower wages and a lack of access to workplace savings opportunities, that creates financial obstacles, especially later in life. The Latina Savings Project seeks to remove financial barriers. Call in with a question. You can add your comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Norma Gallegos-Baez is Workforce and Career Pathways Manager at Centro Hispano of Dane County. And Cindy Hounsell is here, President of the Women's Institute for a Secure Retirement. Cindy, let's take stock for a moment. The project has been going on since 2017. In four other cities, Albuquerque, New Mexico, Baytown, Texas, Fort Worth, Topeka, Kansas. So since its inception, what kind of results have you been seeing?
We have great results just because people are so anxious to have information that once they hear about things that they can do to change, you know, their own lives and take advantage. One of the things I wanted to say is there was a bipartisan bill based in Washington, D.C., so I'm involved in a lot of these issues with what goes on in the bigger retirement picture. But what's wonderful is that there was a bill passed 2 years ago. It goes into effect next year, and it includes something called the Savers Match, which replaces the Savers Tax Credit. And what that does was provide a match from the government for, you know, people who are eligible. But low-income workers, a lot of minority women will definitely be able to get access to this benefit. And it will provide a match for your retirement. Whatever you save, there'll be a government match. So we know from there's other projects that are being held in various states. I think 19 or 20 states have now started their own retirement plan for workers that don't have access at their own workplace. So it's working in those projects, and it will make a big difference when it starts. And there's a request in the law that says that there has to be education from the employers and from the government to make sure that people know about this benefit. So I think that will just change things in a big way. And there are also lots of different ways that there will be better access at the workplace for low-income workers. So I'll just leave it at that.
Is matching dollar for dollar, is that an effective incentive? Does that encourage people to save more money?
Yes, I think, you know, we already have proof of that. So I think it will really make a big difference. I mean, I have hope for the future. I've watched all of these bills not happen for 30 years. So I'm excited that there's finally something, you know, on the table that will make a difference.
Norma, what are your thoughts?
Yes, we saw through Latinas in Savings here in Madison that 76% of our attendees accepted the challenge of starting a savings match. Part of the challenge was if they wanted to join, they saved $20 for 6 months. And at the end, through this partnership with Wise Hermana and TrueStage, we were able to match, in the credit unions, we were able to match $120 at the end of the 6 months. And we saw a 70% success we're able to get the match after the 6 months. And a lot of the testimonials that we gather were, it was the beginning for many Latina women to start their savings account, to start in the mindset of thinking of retirement just as an overall well-being part of their journey. So it's not just saving for retirement, but what does that mean for their families and for the community in general? So we saw success around that.
I want to return to something you said earlier about banks and trust. Can banks do more here to help build trust among its Latina customers in efforts like matches or other things to put aside money and to set these savings goals?
Yes. We found that it is critical to partner with nonprofits, organizations in general that serve Latino community and that have been in Madison or Dane County for years. Centro has been here for 40 years. There's knowledge in the collectiveness of our community. There is wisdom. So when they partner with us, it's easier to build that bridge, because we know that credit unions and banks, they have their own financial resources. They can have resources in Spanish. However, and they've shared this with us, of they can put out workshops, they're usually not very well attended. When they do come to Centro, they found that attendance is a success. And that's because we already have a connection with the community. We already have those relationships. And we trust each other. We see each other. We know what it's like to, and I'll speak personally, I know what it's like to start saving until in your late 20s or not having financial conversations with my parents, with my sisters, with my aunts, and how important that is to start engaging in what does financial literacy and building wealth means for families and for the community in general.
We're exploring the work of the Latina Savings Project. That is Norma Gallegos-Baez at Centro Hispano Dane County. Cindy Hounsell is here at the Women's Institute for a Secure Retirement. You can join in along the way with questions. You can share your comments at 800-642-1234. Cindy, how much of a person's lack of financial savings is a result of poor financial literacy versus this is an earnings problem? This is a problem at businesses.
Well, it is an earnings problem, but as I said, I think when people find out about the opportunities there and things that they can do, and Norma's talking about, you know, the fact that the the credit union that funded the program, TruStage, you know, made a big difference in wanting to provide a match, as if they had a good job at a company that provided a match. And I remember, Norma, one of the success stories that you had was a woman that like went to her employer and she got a few extra hours, like this was during the pandemic, so that she would be eligible for the 401k. And so that wouldn't happen if you don't even know that there's a 401k or that there's something that you should be, you know, taking advantage of in the future.
Mm. But Norma, I mean, there's only so much scrimping and squeezing and saving and frugality. At some point, wages have to be fair to live in these times. What can you say about that lack of equality?
Yeah, that is correct. I think we see financial literacy as a tool. Mm. We can't, it is critical that we don't rely on financial literacy to create pathways out of poverty. When you're making $15 an hour and you are sustaining a family or two or three, and you're paying a rent that is $1,800 a month or more, you can still save. I mean, how are you can still save, but perhaps you might be able to save a minimal amount. And so when we do the math with this, we do, and, you know, me as a workforce and in that space, we do advocate for fair, livable wage here in Madison and Dane County. The cost of living continues to increase, and we can't keep up with a $15 an hour wage.
Yeah.
Even $18 an hour, seeing that it is not getting us where we need to be to from moving from starting to save to build wealth. There's a huge gap in
there. There's a gap. Well, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
That is Norma Gallegos-Baez, Workforce and Career Pathways Manager at Centro Hispano Dane County. Cindy Hounsell leads the Women's Institute for a Secure Retirement. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Finland is consistently ranked as the happiest country in the world. We explore why the United States, one of the wealthiest nations, fails to measure up in an annual comparison of well-being. And you can join the conversation about the World Happiness Report, your thoughts on happiness here in Wisconsin. Call in with a question. You can share comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Christine Whelan is a professor of consumer science at UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. Christine, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Good morning. So America ranks 23rd in the world in this latest report. That's an 8-point drop from last year. What could be contributing to Americans' lower happiness?
Well, certainly we are hearing a lot about increases in loneliness, increases in felt sense of inequality in the United States. And so certainly all of these are contributing to a general cultural narrative that we've got right now that things are not so great and we are not so happy. But I do believe that some of these results need to be taken with a grain of salt, because this ranking is really based on one question in the World Happiness Report, and very small differences in actual scores can make huge differences in terms of those national rankings. So while we have fallen a great deal in 1 year, I expect to see some fluctuation over the coming years.
And that's interesting, because from a research perspective, I wonder what you think of their ladder approach. Think of your life as a ladder, a scale of, 10 to 0. What do you make of that type of way to relate happiness to kind of a ladder?
So the Gallup and the World Happiness Report uses this Cantrell ladder. Mm-hmm. And this ladder is a one question survey where you actually are shown a visual of a ladder with 10 rungs on it. And the idea is for you to sort of situate yourself on this ladder, where the bottom is the worst possible life and the top is the best possible life. And so, as I always explain this to my students, and I encourage everybody who's listening to kind of imagine this themselves, where would you put yourself on this ladder? What rung would you put yourself at from 0 to 10, with 10 being the highest? And, it turns out that what this question is really asking is determined by the sort of set of beliefs that you bring into it. So if you are looking at this ladder, perhaps you are thinking about it in terms of social comparison. Do I have as much money as other people? Do I have as much fun as other people? And social comparison is actually, research finds time and again, the enemy of happiness. Hmm. So some researchers are wondering about this question, but it turns out that most Americans put themselves somewhere between a sort of 7 and an 8 on this ladder. And worldwide, you see similar numbers as well.
And I would imagine, too, that social comparison and social media have a lot in common, that it's hard to avoid, what people are showing and telling on social media about their lives. And then you yourself comparing yourself to that. Is that an issue?
It absolutely is. So the more that we see the idealized versions of other people, the very stylized versions of celebrity success, then the more we tend to feel that we are failing or lower down on that Cantrell ladder. Interestingly enough, the Nordic countries that always score very high on these scales have a somewhat different definition of happiness than we do. So in Finland, when people think about happiness and success, they think about having enough. And they define their well-being based on, do I feel like I generally have enough? Whereas in the United States, when we think about happiness and success and well-being, we think about as more. Do I have everything that I want? And one of the things that we know is that the wanting mind also is never satisfied. Hmm. So that can have us have lower rankings on these scales as well.
We're talking about happiness with Christine Whelan, professor of consumer science at UW-Madison. And you can join the conversation with your thoughts. Call in with a question, and you can share your ideas at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Christine, since 2021, as you mentioned, Finland consistently ranking as the happiest country in the world. And last April, we talked with happiness coach Paula Ima of the Finnish Happiness Research Association about why citizens are so happy.
Finland is a welfare state. We have democratic institutions. We trust each other. We have low corruption rates. So kind of like the elements for happiness and the nation having the systems and structures to support the happiness of its citizens, they are in place, yes.
It sounds like she's saying that they have the scaffolding of happiness. What are your thoughts?
Certainly, when you think about happiness in the as a group happiness, thinking about it in somewhat of a collective sense, where my happiness is really related to your happiness, then having these robust social structures very much helps. When you think of happiness, though, in the individual sense, then whether or not the group is doing well may not be as important to you. So certainly not only are the social structures and the scaffolding important, but the stories that we tell ourselves about what the good life looks like. The more we focus on purpose and meaning and pro-social behavior and think about others, the research shows that that does tend to make us happier. The more we focus on our own success and our own individual happiness and pleasure, well, that tends to be more elusive. So in Finland, I think, you know, in these Nordic countries, they have a narrative of group success. I think we're seeing that in the studies as well.
There was an interesting turn of events in this report saying Americans age 60 and older rank 50 places higher in happiness than people under 30. Why could that be?
This is an incredibly serious turn of events, I think, and it's good that we are starting a national conversation about it. Young people are really unhappy. They are posting sort of loss of meaning. They are feeling more socially isolated, and they are more lonely. Many people are concerned that this is because instead of turning outward toward relationships, they are turning inward and looking at screens. And the more that we isolate ourselves, the less happy we are. Humans are social animals. So there's a lot of really compelling research that is suggesting we need to change the way that we are structuring childhood and the opportunities that we are offering to the young to actually engage in life. This may be a real wake-up call, and it's certainly in keeping with some of the other data that our young people are struggling.
And what I found interesting is the drop isn't unique to the U.S. It's happening elsewhere in the world. And as a professor, you interact with young adults a lot. Do you have insights there about why it might be spreading beyond of, you know, just a situation in the United States?
If we're talking about screens and mobile phone usage, social media usage, that is something we're seeing worldwide. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of loneliness and isolation is occurring to all young people who are increasingly spending 5, 6, 7, even 11 hours a day of almost all their waking time on screens. So this is something we see. And, you know, with my college students, I have a little bit of hope because many of my students are telling me that they're putting their phones on Do Not Disturb. They are increasingly trying to take charge of their digital lives, recognizing that it is not mentally helpful for them. So perhaps this also will be the generation that turns things around.
Christine Whelan, a professor of consumer science at UW-Madison with takeaways on the state of happiness in the world and here in Wisconsin communities. Call in with a question. You can share your perspective at any point, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Nordic countries like Finland and Denmark, they consistently rank among the world's happiest. The United States, it tumbles 8 spots in the latest World Happiness Report, and we examine what could be causing the glum outlook, and we can hear your thoughts along the way. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Christine Whelan is a professor of consumer science in the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison. Christine, in a Gallup poll last year, the poll found roughly 44 million American adults experience significant loneliness. How does loneliness factor into a person's happiness?
The single biggest predictor of somebody's happiness and well-being throughout life, according to dozens and dozens of longitudinal research surveys, is the quality of your relationships. Loneliness really is the antithesis of happiness and thriving. So as we see more and more loneliness in our country and really throughout the world, what we are seeing is a decrease in well-being, a decrease in the amount of time that people are spending face-to-face in relationship with others. And so that actually really is the takeaway that I think we all should have out of this survey, not a comparison in terms of other countries and social comparison to others, but rather thinking about how we can bolster our relationships and really strengthen those quality interactions that bring us the most joy.
What are some practical tips on how to reduce loneliness?
Check in with your friends, pick up the phone, and make a date to see folks face to face. So sending a text message is fine for planning, but is not really going to reduce the loneliness that we see and feel. So really getting off of our screens, getting face to face and coming together, social action, coming together around causes and ideas that you care about, that you are working side by side with others to make a difference. Pro-social behavior, doing nice things for other people, doing things with other people. Anytime we come together, just yesterday, for example, as we all looked up at the skies for the solar eclipse,
yes.
Well, that was a moment of awe and unity. And my bet is that a lot of people felt a little bit less lonely when they saw so many others shoulder to shoulder looking up.
Oh, that's interesting. Let's bring in Chris in Two Rivers with observations. Chris, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. I've traveled to Finland quite a few times for business and have friends there and in Sweden and Denmark. And I would say that the people there don't, you know, going to the country, don't seem to think that they're any more bubbly or overtly happy than we are in the United States. But one thing I notice in particular in those countries is that there isn't as much worry. You know, people don't have to worry about, am I going to be able to pay for healthcare if I have a tragic accident within my family. And they also try to spend time with friends and family, like the sauna situation in Finland, which is great, getting together once a week with the family or friends and getting outdoors and enjoying nature, whether it's in the middle of winter or in the summertime. I think those things really contribute.
Chris, I appreciate you calling in and with that perspective of traveling to Finland and having friends in Nordic countries. Christine, what stands out to you?
Absolutely. Those are two really excellent points. So certainly the lack of anxiety about what's going to happen in the worst case scenarios, this is where social services and a safety net can really alleviate people's fears for the future. So that's one very good point. And yes, a culture that encourages people to come together. In a couple decades ago, Robert Putnam, a famous sociologist, wrote a book called Bowling Alone about how the United States used to have more groups where people would come together and fewer and fewer people are joining in community. So certainly if the Nordic countries are doing more of that than we are, that is a big contributor to happiness.
Let's bring in Sherry now in Madison. Sherry, what are your thoughts?
Hi. I really appreciate this. I would say that one of the factors in terms of happiness is the country you live in. So if, you know, in the United States with guns and climate change and incivility like we've had, I think that makes a difference. My question, though, is about young people and whether it's the screen so much or also the sense of eco-anxiety because of climate change affecting their future.
Oh, Sherry, thank you. That's a great question. Christine.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, I think that it is certainly true that that climate change, that structural issues are affecting people. And then also the idea of are we going to have to be the ones to save the world? Are we the ones have to be the individuals who are doing all of this ourselves? So certainly all of these factors really come into play.
Talking about the World Happiness Report with Christine Whelan, Professor of Consumer Science at UW-Madison. Christine, you teach a course on consuming happiness at UW-Madison. I'm wondering if we could audit the course for just a bit. What might we learn?
Absolutely. So in the course, I talk about how we try to buy happiness successfully and unsuccessfully in the market economy. And one of the things that we talk about is while certainly having more money can allow you to use your resources to maximize your well-being, unless you're spending in keeping with your values, then more money does not buy more happiness. So I talk about spending on experiences rather than things, on spending on pro-social behavior, and really thinking about what matters to you and why it matters before thinking about trying to buy a quick fix wellness solution. Those are some of the things we're talking about this semester.
I wonder what comes up in your group discussions when you make these recommendations.
Well, certainly young people are saying that they are bombarded with quick fix solutions. The wellness programs that we're seeing are just everywhere out there. And we're seeing so much social media selling them something like a bath salts or something to be happier. But really, they are looking for larger answers, and they are very well aware of the mental health crises and the sort of sense of loneliness and isolation that they face. I have real hope for this generation. I begin to see the tide turning, and I think these are the kids that are going to say, enough is enough already. We want to make some change.
Let's go to Mark in Milwaukee. Mark, go ahead.
Thank you, Kate. I just want to say that your morning show is one of the things that makes me happy.
Oh, thank you.
Really, your part. I'm wondering if your guest has any perspective on whether we can learn something from the ancient Greek philosophers like Aristotle, who described happiness as a form of activity rather than a state of mind where we measure how much we've amassed, rather the activity of our seeking our potential and what is within our power rather than what is external.
Mark, thank you. Christine.
Oh, Mark, your question just made me so happy because I, in fact, teach Aristotle and his Nicomachean Ethics as the beginning of my course. So Aristotle talks about two different types of happiness. He talks about hedonic happiness, which is about pleasure, and eudaimonic happiness, which is about a sort of purpose and meaning-driven sort of sense of happiness that really is focused on relationships and, yes, on doing things that are meaningful to you. So when I talk about purposeful life, purpose is really a verb, not a noun. And happiness is definitely something that is a byproduct of living a life of purpose. So it's not about something that you get or buy at a store. Really, yes, it is an action and it is a choice that we can all make day in and day out. Now, that has a lot of opportunity for many of us, but it also puts pressure on us if we are feeling anxious, that it's all up to us and that we need to do it all on our own. That's not true either. So thinking about making the choice in community with others and in relationship with others about things you care about, yes, Aristotle has and so many of the ancient philosophers have said some really important things. So yes, thanks for bringing Aristotle up this morning.
In closing, though, on the flip side of that, putting a dollar amount on it, there was a study found happiness levels among households making over $123,000 a year largely stayed the same when given more money. So what do you make there of a money threshold for happiness?
Yeah, so this was called the Easterlin paradox, and it was coined back in the 1970s that up to a certain point, more money does buy happiness, but in the end of the day, more money does not buy happiness in grand quantities. I think what that means is that as we want more, as we have more, we want more, and just spending on money on things is not going to make us happy. However, other research did find that you can use your money to maximize your well-being if you spend it right. So my advice to everyone is to spend on relationships rather than things, and to spend on others, on causes you care about. And in that case, more money can buy you more happiness if you spend it wisely.
Christine, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. It was great to have this conversation this morning.
Appreciate it. Christine Whelan is a professor of consumer science in the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Millions of Americans juggle college and parenthood, and women are disproportionately likely to be raising kids as they pursue a degree. That is from the Institute for Women's Policy Research. We learn about the Kids on Campus initiative that aims to bring Head Start centers to community college campuses. Call in with a question. You can share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Victoria Jones is Senior Director of Data at the National Head Start Association and leads the Kids on Campus initiative. Victoria, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me. Excited to be here.
So Head Start aims to expand childcare offerings at community colleges. Can you tell us why target support for this group of people?
Absolutely. So student parents are a population that often feels pretty invisible on college campuses, despite the fact that the numbers are kind of astounding. Student parents are far more common on campus than most people realize, and they have a unique set of needs that often aren't considered because of that. So as the data person, I promise I came with numbers on the scope of student parents in higher ed. And as you guys have been mentioning some of the numbers throughout this morning, 22% or more than one in five of today's college students are parents, which is about 3.8 million people. And among those, 1.7 million are single moms, and the vast majority of those have incomes at or near the poverty line.
Wow.
And so among those 3.8 million student parents, about 53% of them have kids under six. So they're that's before they've gone off to elementary school. And so all that to say, student parents represent a really large chunk, actually, of our higher ed population. And most schools don't even realize that or necessarily have the data to know how many of them are on their campuses. And the fact that they face a far different set of barriers than kind of the image most of us hold in our head of the traditional college student.
Yes, the traditional college student. I mean, colleges, even in tours, they may show off these really well-appointed student centers and these really nice rec centers. Are college campuses prioritizing a childcare feature or as a benefit for students?
It's not something that we've seen all that often. They're starting to realize, they're starting to collect data to really understand what are the specific numbers on their campuses, what are the needs of their specific students. But since 2003, we've seen over 100 on-campus childcare centers close.
Wow.
And the reality is that most of the time, those centers are operating in the red. Childcare centers are expensive, and community colleges and colleges writ large are still businesses, and it's hard for them to manage the space for the tiny humans when they're mostly set up for the adult learners.
When you interact with these childcare centers on college campuses, are they generally being fiscally funded by and supported by the families who go to these centers, or is it more of the college campus itself that it's coming out of its budget? How do they work financially?
We've seen that really go both ways. Sometimes it is more of a private pay model that the staff has and faculty has much more access to than the students themselves. Sometimes the colleges are willing to put some money behind it because they do know how important it is for their students. And that's something that we see as really beneficial with Head Start because it is free for those who are eligible for it.
So enter with Head Start here. Can you tell us about its approach and what type of model you want to really roll out on community college campuses?
Absolutely. So for those who aren't super familiar, I'll start with the basics, which is that Head Start is a federal to local early childhood education model committed to this 360-degree development of children. So the money for Head Start goes directly from the federal level down to those individual community-based organizations that actually provide the services. And for the most part, there's in-classroom services, there is some home visiting work as well, but Head Start programs provide really well-rounded classroom experiences and then also offer support beyond the classroom, all the way from before birth through age five. And you know, there are approximately 1,600 organizations that provide Head Start services. They operate more than 16,000 physical centers across the country. So everywhere from the base of the Grand Canyon to rural communities to the inner city, it's really everywhere, serving more than 800,000 children and families every year. But we don't see that many on college campuses yet. And so we're really excited to start increasing that number and really integrate Head Start into campuses for everyone's benefit.
How has that work been going? I mean, even you could even perhaps of these 16,000 physical campuses, some could potentially move to more convenient locations for these parents, like a community college campus.
Exactly. We're seeing a real benefit, kind of, we call it a win-win-win, and there may even be a fourth win in there for society at writ large, because the Head Start campuses get space, they could get kind of easy access to a population of students that could really benefit from their services. The college then has a childcare center on campus that they don't have to run. And you can also kind of build in other possible funding sources so that everyone has access to the center. And the children and our families are getting a really great education experience for the kids. They're getting that family support, and they're actually able to kind of, you know, travel to campus together, go to school together in the morning and come back home at the end of the day.
We're talking about Head Start, integrating it with community college campuses around the country and the state of childcare itself. Victoria Jones with us, Senior Director of Data at the National Head Start Association. You can join in with questions and comments about the Kids on Campus initiative, what you see in your own community. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I wonder, Victoria, coming from the data perspective, is it possible to make that clear connection between the impact of a campus childcare and student outcomes, students finishing their degree or being able to take courses?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things we've seen that's really interesting coming from the data is that actually student parents are kind of on average have higher GPAs than non-parenting students. But we also see that it is a lot harder for them to get all the way through school. A lot of them are working, sometimes part-time, sometimes full-time, while also going to school and raising children. And the number of hours a day that that takes up is quite a few. And right now, kind of what the data we have shows that only about 28% of single mothers graduate within 6 years of enrollment, despite the fact that student parents tend to have higher GPAs. And given the cost of childcare writ large, the availability or the benefits of making childcare available on campus are going to help with everything from persistence in school, actually completing courses, completing a degree, you know, maybe even bringing in some parents who weren't initially planning to go to college, but if they happen to be on campus, they may suddenly see that as a place where they're welcome, and you could actually see them begin to enroll in higher ed degrees.
I would imagine, too, if a typical student parent would have to perhaps make a choice to be able to afford childcare or to pay tuition. So it would seem that if a choice has to come to that, a free childcare center really makes sense in that difficult moment and that type of decision.
Absolutely.
Let's take a call now. Matt in Mequon is with us. Matt, go ahead.
All right, so mine's more of a comment. So I believe that education, the earlier the better, it's going to be one of the best investments in your communities, your states, in your country. And right now, the way our tax code is set up, it's set up so that roughly half of our federal income taxes we pay go to military spending, to wars that are being created all over the world, and very little goes to education. And I just wonder, like, you know, this is a, we keep getting told that we don't have money for education, but that's just a bunch of baloney. And I think Americans better start realizing this and better start putting their foot down with what's going on, because our country is just getting deteriorated by the day.
Matt, thank you for the call. And making a connection here between education spending and childcare rolled into that type of education, do you see that as well, Victoria?
Yeah, absolutely. There is absolutely a need for more funding for education as a whole, and particularly in Head Start. We have a team that works on that tirelessly year after year.
How can a student parent better advocate for themselves on college campuses? You said earlier that they can be invisible.
Yeah, it can be hard to speak up, especially when you're running around doing, three, four full-time jobs, essentially, between school and work and parenting. But it is important to connect with the people on your campuses, actually share with them what your struggles are and share with them what benefits would come from that. There are also other kind of community organizations out there to speak to suggest partnerships so that you're not asking the college to take on a new burden that they maybe weren't prepared for, but instead can bring to them a partnership, someone who can work with them on a specific area that they're the experts in already.
It also makes me wonder whether in community college administration, is there a point person or department that really looks after this type of student body?
I believe there is, but one of the things we're learning from this project is the vast difference between higher ed and early education. We've mixed up a lot of acronyms between the two of us, and part of this project we've undertaken not just as NHSA, but with our partners at the Association for Community College Trustees, is to bring that expertise from both sides. Because Head Start programs and students on campus don't necessarily know who to reach out to for that. Similarly, the community colleges don't necessarily know who to reach out to at Head Start. And so as soon as you start talking about this, people get really excited and they want to do it because it's such a kind of clear overlap and clear beneficial project. So we are learning together with ACCT who is the right person to talk to on both sides of the aisle.
Victoria Jones is Senior Director of Data at the National Head Start Association, leading the Kids on Campus initiative, which aims to establish Head Start centers on community college campuses around the nation. You can be part of this discussion. You can call in with a question, share thoughts along the way. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Millions of college students in Wisconsin and across the nation raise children while earning a degree. We explore an initiative between community colleges and the Head Start program to provide free preschool childcare for qualifying students. Victoria Jones leads the Kids on Campus initiative at the National Head Start Association and is joining us. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Victoria, UW Oshkosh is not a community college, but it has a Head Start center. What type of potential is there for more Head Start centers on college campuses, two-year campuses or four-year campuses?
Yeah, we see a ton of opportunity here, which is wonderful. From our latest analysis, we believe there are about 130 community college campuses nationwide that have a Head Start center on them right now, which isn't bad. However, that's 130 of about 3,000 total community college campuses. And that's just looking at those two-year community colleges. And there are about 16,000 Head Start centers across the country. So those 130 show us that this is entirely doable, but there's really kind of exponential potential for growth here.
So if you are a college and are having this type of conversation about how to support students and looking at adding a childcare center, what should those early discussions be like? What would you suggest for college administrators?
Well, we definitely recommend getting in touch with us as part of this project because we have lots to share. But even without doing that, the biggest thing we can really recommend is to talk to the student parents on your campus. To to make sure that you're really understanding from them, what do they need? What's working well? What supports could they benefit from? What are some of the policies or physical designs of your campuses that are making it harder for them than it needs to be? And working with them to kind of craft what could really benefit them on campus.
When you look at that statistic that the number of campuses offering childcare services declined 14% from 2004 to 2019, that's from the Institute for Women's Policy Research, what is behind that decline? What are the challenges to, establishing and keeping a childcare center presence on campus?
Yeah, so there's absolutely the financial component, as we were discussing before, and a lot of those childcare centers are operating in the red, especially during COVID. We saw a lot of centers closing down. But despite that, there's really this logic to this project and these partnerships. And so what we're finding throughout this last year or so is a couple different things. One is that there's a really big divide between early education and higher ed. We kind of often see ourselves as completely separate industries, mm-hmm. and student parents is really where we overlap, but there's not enough conversation happening about how we kind of design our campuses and our policies to really support that group. And then higher ed and early ed are structured really differently. And so college campuses aren't necessarily designed to be able to, to be accessible to the tiny humans. Often they're not even set up to be accessible for the people pregnant with the tiny humans. So to set up a physical space, design a high quality program is a really different experience when you're talking about little kids as opposed to adult learners. And similarly from the Head Start side, we don't talk about course credits and semesters on a regular basis. We don't instinctively know whether the provost or the chancellor is an important person that we should be talking to. And so one of the great things that this partnership brings to the table is a sustainable funding source that represents kind of high quality 360-degree support for children and families, while also not asking the colleges themselves to take on the burden of running a child care center when it's not something they're that familiar with.
Well, I wonder if there is one intersection here in that higher ed is also offering degrees oftentimes related to early childhood education. Certainly in their education departments, there is research underway in early childhood. Is there a way that college education programs could be more directly tied into a campus childcare center and have it more as a lab setting, if you will?
Absolutely. In the 130 programs that or campuses that currently have Head Start centers, we definitely see the Head Start classrooms being used as a lab school. There's great opportunities for those students to come in to the classroom and do a practicum, do an internship for the semester, have a part-time job after school. That is kind of a small dent in the bucket of the workforce crisis, but is a really strong benefit for both the college students and the Head Start program to have those passionate bodies be able to get experience in the classroom. And from this project, we've seen that there are actually so many other partnerships even beyond the education departments working together with the child care center.
Can you give an example? Like what?
Yeah, so we've seen a really cool one that I think it's in Alabama, where the Head Start program bought a fleet of vehicles to help transport kids to and from school each day, help parents access, doctor's appointments and the like. And the auto shop students on campus maintains that fleet of vehicles.
Huh. Wow.
So they actually get the practical hands-on experience. They get to see those vehicles driving around campus with the little kiddos on them. And Head Start gets, the free support of the auto shop.
We're talking about Head Start and childcare, the intersections at community college campuses, with Victoria Jones, Senior Director of Data at the National Head Start Association. Call in with your insights. Call in questions and comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Victoria, the Association of Community College Trustees, you mentioned that earlier, it says that 180,000 spots for childcare remain unfilled. And although you say this number is outdated, can you tell us why Head Start struggles to fill spots for free childcare?
Yeah, so the biggest thing to know about that is obviously it was a point in time measure from over a year ago. But the big piece of that is not that there isn't need and isn't demand from the children and families, it's that we don't have the workforce. Anyone familiar with education news kind of knows there's a major workforce crisis in education right now. And this project isn't going to be the silver bullet that solves the issue of, you know, low wages and kind of low respect in particular for the predominantly women who are in our classrooms each day shaping the minds of children. And so the issue is really trying to get more funding, get more support, because the professional staff in Head Start are really shouldering the burden of this experience, and we're seeing high turnover rates. And, you know, we've recommended very significant funding in our request to Congress for the next fiscal year to try to really turn around the industry.
Will additional funding turn it around? I mean, in our last moments together, the Institute says Head Start needs an additional $12.5 billion in funding for teacher salaries and improving programs.
Yeah, and that's just to bring the level of professionalism and respect to the Head Start workforce that they deserve after kind of years of hard work of supporting children and families. And, you know, on top of that, Head Start current right now is only able to serve about 33% of eligible preschool kiddos and about 10% of eligible infant and toddlers. And so if we really want to expand to bring Head Start to all eligible children and families, we're going to need a really big commitment.
Victoria, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Victoria Jones is Senior Director of Data at the National Head Start Association, where she leads the Kids on Campus initiative. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.